Hello, my name is Rory O'Connor, and I am president of the International Association for Suicide Prevention. I'm delighted to welcome you to our new podcast series called Reach In, Reach Out. We're hoping to encourage safe conversations around suicide and suicide prevention, and we aim to bring together the different aspects of the work that we do, providing a global perspective, but crucially also sharing stories of hope. A fundamental part of our work is engaging with people with lived and living experience of suicide, either through their own personal experiences of suicidality or through loss and grief. This will be a central strand running through the entire podcast series. Given the sensitive nature of the subject matter, it is vital that we all prioritize our well-being. So please practice self-care. I hope that you find the podcast of interest, and we really look forward to hearing what you have to think. Thank you. Welcome to the latest episode of YASP's podcast, Reach In, Reach Out. Today, I'm delighted with two fantastic guests from different parts of the world, different sides of the world. We've got Amy Chandler, and Amy's with us in Edinburgh. And we've got Diane Machado. And Diane, where are you currently? Because I know you're obviously Brazil. You're split time between Brazil and America. Where are you currently? You're in Brazil at the minute, aren't you?
Yes, I'm in Brazil, in Salvador, by the beach.
Oh, by the beach. Well, neither Amy and I currently have that pleasure. And if we had that pleasure, I recorded something earlier this morning. And out you can see my window. They thought it was snow. And I said, no, it's not quite that bad. It's a good day. In Glasgow, we had sunshine today in Glasgow. Anyway, enough about that. So maybe, Danny, just sticking with you, can you tell us a bit about, tell our listeners who you are, what's your background, and before we get into the nitty-gritty, this podcast really going to be focusing on the social determinants of suicide risk. So maybe you can tell us a bit about you. Who are you?
I am Diane. I am a psychologist. I am from Brazil, and I'm working as a researcher associate here at Cidade Fiocruz. And I'm also a researcher at Harvard Medical School, where we are investigating suicide and mental health outcomes.
Fantastic. So, Danny, so in terms of what's the split in your time? Are you mostly in Brazil?
No, I'm mostly in Boston, but I come very often to Brazil and spend some months here at the center, the research center here.
Okay, cool. And so the research center in Brazil, is that a specifically suicide prevention center or?
Actually not. I am leading the mental health group, but the center has over 200 people studying maternal health, child health, and there are many other studies. And actually this center is most focused on using big cohort of over 100 million inhabitants in Brazil, but the other people are studying all the outcomes related to health, but okay, not specifically suicide. My team, my group is studying suicide.
Okay, great. And then when you're in Boston, in Harvard, which department are you affiliated with in Boston?
I am at the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine, at the Mental Health Ball Lab that's led by Vikram Patel.
Ah, okay, great. Fantastic, fantastic. Amy, over to you then. So Amy, obviously, I know you well. I have the pleasure of working with you over several years. So can you tell us a bit about who you are for the listener, the uninitiated listener?
Sure. So I'm a sociologist and I'm based at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland in the UK, where I've been for many years. And I also research suicide. And I currently lead a small team that's using qualitative methods largely to research how suicide is experienced and made sense of and also responded to across different communities in Scotland. And I've done all sorts of other bits and pieces over the years as well.
Oh, thanks, Amy. Thanks, Amy. That's helpful. Maybe if we stick with you, Amy, because we're going to, so what we're hoping to do is have a conversation about obviously the work that you both do or have been doing as well, but really then trying to think about maybe on a sort of more national, international level, looking at the sort of social determinants issues and both in terms of our understanding and then crucially, what we can do in terms of interventions. And we'll obviously we'll talk a bit about the work, Diana, you've been doing in Brazil with the conditional cash transfers. Mm-hmm. But maybe, Amy, sticking with you then, can you tell us a bit about the work you've done? Because you use really innovative methods. And when you just described yourself there as a qualitative researcher, I think, to me, that just
sort of engenders this idea of just doing interviews. And when I say just, I don't mean just. I mean, you've got a whole range of methodologies you use, and you're mm-hmm. really trying to sort of expand the art and science of suicide prevention. So do you want to tell us a bit about that from, I suppose, your PhD work and then since your PhD and the amazing work you're doing with the Wellcome?
Sure. I'll try and do it in a concise way.
No need to be concise, Amy.
Cut it if it's too rambly. Yeah, so as a qualitative researcher, yeah, often that does invite an idea of using particular types of methods, specifically one-to-one interviews, and a huge amount of qualitative research does use one-to-one interviews. And I certainly have done that for much of the research that I've done. So starting with my PhD, which involved doing one-to-one interviews with people who had experience with self-harm, or I specifically was looking at experiences of self-injury for that. But there are limits, I think, to what we can do with a one-to-one interview, as important as they are, and as central as they remain to a lot of the studies that I do. But qualitative research more generally involves being interested in exploring kind of how people make sense of or explain or give meaning to all sorts of different things. And obviously for me, I'm interested in practices of self-harm and suicide and also responses to them. So as well as interviewing people who've had direct experiences with self-harm or suicide, we've also across different studies been involved in interviewing and speaking with professionals who respond to people at risk of or who have experienced self-harm or suicide. So general practitioners or primary care physicians, but also in my more recent work, we've been working with third sector or charity organisations who support people in community settings who are at risk of suicide, and exploring how they make sense of suicide among the people that they work with and how they respond to it. So other approaches that use qualitative methods and so have the same aim of exploring kind of meanings and understandings and responses and sense making around self-harm and suicide. We use something called ethnography, which some listeners may be really familiar with, but others perhaps less so. And ethnography involves kind of, one way it's described is deep hanging out. So it's where a researcher spends a lot of time in a place or with a group of people, and kind of, so instead of having a one-off interview with them, we'll have repeated, ongoing conversations, we'll develop relationships with them where they kind of get to know sort of the rhythms of life in that place. And that can help us to really make better sense of what people might say otherwise in a one-off interview that's kind of lacks much context actually about where their lives are lived. So when we're thinking about social determinants of health, which I know we're focusing on for this podcast, that can be really, really important in terms of being able to look at kind of what is the kind of the environment, like the material environment, the cultural environment, and how does that relate to what people say about and make sense of suicide. So ethnography is another approach. And I've also used approaches using art as a way of kind of trying to tap into and make sense of self-harm and suicide, which are often difficult to articulate actually for people, and open up different ways of knowing. So those are the more kind of, I still continue to experiment with those methods, but they are, also useful. So those are some of them.
Yeah, but so how have you found, though, the ethnography approach or mm-hmm. the ethnographic approach, Amy? I mean, it obviously brings its own challenges as well as potential insights.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I've been really fortunate to work with a team of colleagues who are more expert in ethnography than I am. So I work currently with a team that are based, their backgrounds are in anthropology, mm-hmm. community psychology, and also social geography. So each of them have brought kind of different expertise to their own research roles of doing ethnography. But it's been incredibly useful, I think, particularly in terms of like when we do an interview-based study, we often get the same people coming forward. They're often women. They're often fairly articulate. They're often fairly well educated. And again, with the types of, types of issues that we're interested in, particularly around social determinants, the role of poverty and inequalities and other kind of ways in which people can be marginalized or excluded, those kinds of groups are often categorized in social research as being hard to reach. And so ethnography is one way in which we can shift our methods actually to make them more amenable and more open and more accessible to people. So we kind of go to where they are and hang out, get to know them, build trust, so that we can have kind of like more ongoing kind of conversations rather than trying to arrange to sit down at a certain time in a certain place with a researcher, which can be incredibly off-putting and intimidating to people, especially if they quite rightly often don't have much trust in professionals. Yeah, so that's one way in which the ethnographic approach has been really helpful. There are others to talk about.
Hang on, this is a really fascinating area. So what others?
Well, so again, I guess one of the key others would be that with ethnography, you're going to where people are and where they live their lives. So some of the stuff that in a one-to-one interview, we're trying to kind of get from what somebody says about their lives. With ethnography, we're with them, seeing and experiencing that with them. And obviously the researcher's experience of that is going to be different from the people who live that day to day, and that is their lives. But it provides certainly another layer in which we can then better situate and better make sense of, you know, why suicide and self-harm might be experienced or practiced or explained in this particular place, in this particular way, because we're able to sort of see how it's all playing out, you know, watch the interactions between different kinds of service providers and the people that kind of come into a particular organization, for instance. So, great.
Maybe that's something we might pick up later in the conversation when we try and disentangle the social demographic or the social determinants and how we, because I think that one of the challenges is that I think if we just stick with the existing evidence base, it's very limited. And you touched on the obviously difficult, hard to reach, which of course is a misnomer, because what it really means is we just have failed to reach these people and we haven't thought cleverly enough about it or engaged them in a way which ensures they will hopefully we can get in contact with them. But that's maybe something we'll come back to. So Danny, moving on to you then, and in terms of your story, I think I first heard about your work actually was from Vikram Patel at a meeting. I can't remember where it was, but he was talking about the work obviously on the conditional cash transfer work in Brazil. So tell us about your journey thus far in suicide prevention research.
So I started studying suicide during my undergrad in Brazil. I remember back in time, I was thinking, I really want to work with patients that are severe and really needs my help. Not meaning by that the others did not need, but I just wanted to make a difference in someone's life. So back in time, I started studying to see patients as a clinical psychologist. But during the studies, I ended up doing well in research and I got passionate about it. I loved it. And I thought that developing my career into research, I actually could help the government to make better decisions and by providing evidence-based data. And I thought it would be nice to help the government to make better decisions in terms of prevention in Brazil. So I try to impact more people there, seeing one by one. Mm-hmm. Although both approaches are very important for suicide prevention.
Yeah, although you're a psychologist, I mean, in a way, your approach is like a public health type approach as well, isn't it? And well, it's that intersection.
Yes, my undergrad was in psychology and I was more focused in clinical psychology, but then my master's and PhD were in epidemiology and population health. So I still use my psychologist background, but I use more to analyze, to interpret the data. But the approach in the research is more like statistical, it's more like populational. So we have been studying like rates and determination, and I haven't been studying the whole country. The opposite of M, that has the opportunity of accessing people like one by one. For us, we use the data from the whole country and see what's going on.
So that's a sort of broad epidemiological work. I'm just curious then, in terms of the conditional cash transfer work, so could you tell us how that came about and what you did and crucially what you found?
Yes. So during my master's, I started studying if income inequality, Brazil, give a little bit of background, we have a very high income rate and income inequality, and we are one of the most unequal countries around the world. So it impacts on people's life and impacts on people's mental health. It impacts psychologically, but also in terms of practical measures, like it makes people have less access to treatments, to healthcare. So I started wondering, and if this income inequality would it be impacting also on the suicide rates. So I did the first study during my master's, and I found that municipalities with a higher income inequality also had higher suicide rates, and it was statistically associated. And then later on, I started investigating as well if the municipalities with high income would have lower rates. We also found this association, and we And then later we also investigated the austerity measures, if the time when Brazil started in the austerity measures. And Brazil was already having like an increase in the suicide rates, which is contrary of the worldwide suicide decreasing, but in Brazil it's increasing. And during the austerity measures, the increase was even more speedy, was even higher. So we have been consistently finding association between socioeconomic factors and increased suicide risk in Brazil. So, and then I tried to understand if the community mental health services were able to do something to prevent those deaths. We did not find association. I explain later why, but might be, but we did not find association. So since socioeconomic factors have been highly associated with increased risk, and the mental health services were not associated with decreased risk, the next question was, so a cash transfer program, a socioeconomic intervention, would then prevent suicide in Brazil? And then that's how we end up in the investigated Bolsa Família program, the Brazilian Bolsa Família program. And we found a very high impact, up to 56% decreased risk among the people who received the Bolsa Família.
Mm-hmm. And so in terms of the cash transfer, how did it actually work in practice? And what was the conditional element of it?
So in Brazil, there are two types of programs. These programs is all over the world. There are in many other countries. And there are two types. One is conditional and unconditional. For Brazil, we have the conditional. So it's not like universal basic income. The universal basic income gives money to everyone, no matter the income level. In Brazil, we focus on poorer people. Mm-hmm. So according to like the poorer, we check who are the poorer, and there is a threshold. If your family receive per capita up to 140 reals, and if there is a pregnant woman or if there is a child, and then the cutoff points are a bit higher. So, and this cutoff point has been changed over time, accounted for inflation. So it depends on which you're checking, but in sum, we transfer money for the poorest families in Brazil under certain conditionalities, which are if you have a kid, your kid must attend school. Mm-hmm. If you have a pregnant woman, they must attend all in the family. If there is a pregnant woman, they have to attend all the medical appointments. And if there is a small child, it has also to be vaccinated. With that, the government idea was to prevent children from being on the streets. Mm-hmm. And then there is a big discussion. I am aware of some studies in the USA that say that you don't need the conditionalities. But I add that it depends on which context you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you put a conditionality in Scotland for kids to be at school, maybe it doesn't make sense because probably most kids or all of them are going to school.
Yeah.
But in Brazil, there is a urgent need to take these kids out of the streets and putting them at school. And this was one of the strategies of the government.
Yeah, because I think actually, in terms of the context, I think there's a pilot study going on somewhere in the north of England or the Midlands of England on conditional cash transfer. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens with that. But crucially, what the conditionalities are, because of course, it has to be relevant to the setting that people are in. No, really, really fascinating work. And just one last one, then I'm going to go back to Amy then for sort of start this broader discussion on social determinants. Was there much political pushback, or how easy was it to get it implemented? So how did you get from this idea? Or was it that this was the government liked this as an idea and you were pushing on an open door? Or how did that actually happen, that interface between here's a good idea and how do you get it into practice?
Do you mean in terms of the government to implement the program or in terms of, yeah. So in Brazil, the left wing, the left wing government, and before Bolsa Família, there were other programs. And then with the election of Lula in 2004, the left wing government, they took all these programs and decided to unify it and transform it into a Bolsa Família program. So it became a national program that was expanded everywhere in Brazil. And it was to make it easy, the government back in time made it a national policy. The problem with that was that people started seeing it as a partidary program, like which wing it is. And as researchers, we have been so many benefits of these programs, not only in mental health, but also in physical health, decreasing child mortality, decreasing maternal mortality, and so on, that what we have is that although it was helpful that one side of the government decided to take it, it's a national program. But as a researcher and seeing all the benefits of this program, we argue that it should be taken as a human right, as a social protection, no matter which politics are in charge of the government, if it's the right or left wing. And we base this argument on the evidence that we have seen so many decreased risks in mental health and also in physical health.
Great. No, that's helpful. That's really helpful context. And in terms of it, the sort of ongoingness of it, or is it still happening?
Yes. Yeah, it's still happening. We had some changes in the program before because the right wing was leading, but now we are back on the left wing and they are investing even more in the program. But that's what I was actually pointing out before. It shouldn't be always vulnerable to who is leading. It should be discussed as a human right, as a protection. Not
on the whim of politicians. Exactly. Exactly. But that brings us quite nicely maybe back to Amy. And I suppose thinking about suicide and suicide prevention as being a human right, the right to live in a society in which promotes your mental health and promotes your physical health, which obviously is fundamental to various international charters. Amy, so can we go back to you? So obviously your work has always been grounded in looking at inequalities, and indeed, I suppose you've been in part influenced by Steve Platts, obviously, who many people know on this podcast, Steve Platts, who's one of our previous vice presidents of YASP, and obviously was your PhD supervisor. So Amy, do you want to tell us then about, the novice listener, somebody who doesn't know about the social determinants of suicide. Do you want to tell us what we know about that?
I'll do my best. I think as I flagged originally with this, because the podcast has obviously got a global outlook and a lot of my work has largely been focused on a UK context, but in the UK, we've known for some time, and especially through the work of my PhD supervisor, Steve Platt, there is in the UK also, as in Brazil, a strong gradient or strong relationship between socioeconomic disadvantage and inequality and higher rates of suicide. So one of the areas that I've been particularly interested in the work that I've done is trying to understand why that is, I think, you know, because there is, you know, there's a lot of work has looked at the social determinants of suicide and has underlined that certain factors that are easily measurable, such as income or area level disadvantage, and also gender, and also sometimes how those intersect, are related to suicide. But then understanding why those relationships exist is sometimes kind of less often explored. And particularly, again, because my research tends to be qualitative, because I'm interested in, you know, what aspects of people's experiences of living in poverty, having a particular social position that's associated with a high risk of suicide, then, you know, speaking to those people, finding out about their lives and drawing on other kinds of insights might help us to better understand, rather than what is often done is, which is to imagine or hypothesize about what that relationship might be. So, yeah, so I think in terms of what can I tell you about the social determinants of suicide? So, yeah, we know income in a lot of places is strongly related, but also, and I think this is important in terms of what Diane's work kind of contributes, is that it's not just about income per se, but also about inequalities and the kind of the gap between those that have the most and those that have the least. And again, you know, we know from research more broadly about the social determinants of health that income inequalities, as well as, you know, kind of actual poverty, are both related to, you know, poorer mental health outcomes and also physical health outcomes. You know, so there are really important reasons why governments might want to look at inequalities and look at kind of trying to reduce levels of poverty, but also the gap between the rich and the poor. But unfortunately, we also know that in the UK and the United States, that's not happened particularly. And often kind of things that might affect those things are at the whim of governments. So, yes, I'll stop there.
Yeah. No, but actually, obviously, points couldn't agree more. And I suppose I'm wondering then, Diane, comparing that to the Brazil context, that you said earlier that I didn't realize this, that Brazil had one of the countries in the world with the greatest inequality. And so what, so I'm just trying to sense, and I don't know this off the top of my head, where is the rates of suicide in Brazil compared to, for example, the UK or the United States?
So in Brazil, we are 6 per 100,000 inhabitants. And you might think that's not as high as other countries, but it depends of which race you are talking about. So make a link with the inequality. Besides the income inequality in Brazil, we have a very strong racial inequality. So if you check the rates among the First Nations, this rate is over 200% higher compared to the overall rate in Brazil. And one interesting thing about this group is that in our recent study, we found that while they are at the highest risk, with over 200% higher risk of dying by suicide, when you check the hospitalization rates among First Nations, is very, very low, which may be indicating unequal access to emergency services. So this racial inequalities in Brazil refers to disparity in distribution of power, in economic resources, opportunities, and also access to health care.
Yeah, I'm still surprised. So you said the rate per 100,000 was 6 per 100,000. Because, I mean, that is quite a bit lower than the UK, which is about 10 or 11 per 100,000. But I suppose then it also depends on the quality of the suicide data, how the data are recorded. Mm-hmm. But it'd be interesting, because I'm surprised at that, in the sense that I would have expected it to be higher. I mean, obviously, globally, we know that some of the Scandinavian countries, some of the Russian and countries, obviously much higher, or previous Russian related countries have much higher suicide rates.
Yeah.
So maybe it's a Southern Hemisphere, other end of the world thing as well. Yeah, so I don't know. It'd be interesting. I'm just curious about why, because I would have, Amy, have you a view on that?
I just think the point that Diane raised about that the rate is so much more starkly higher, among certain kind of racial and ethnic groups in Brazil, though, is really telling. Because I think, sometimes when we're looking at sort of social determinants across a whole population that's very, diverse in lots of ways, kind of comparing, you're not necessarily comparing like with like there, are you? I think, in the UK, we, until very recently, have lacked any statistics about what suicide rates are in relation to ethnicity. Mm-hmm. So, it could, so I think, there's lots of kind of unanswered questions there. But I think, countries are, very diverse in terms of what the social determinants might look like and how they play out for different groups within that kind of broader population. That's just my thoughts on hearing that, because I also was like, oh, that does sound a bit lower. But actually then, if that rate is that much higher among certain groups, that's,
Yeah, but I'm still intrigued because, in other First Nations country, in other First Nation populations in Australia, in Canada, the suicide rates are also much higher. Than the other population. So yeah, no, it's just a curious one. But the point is still the same exactly. There's huge inequalities everywhere, and it's looking at the intersectionality of those inequalities, not just looking at, it's obviously looking at ethnicity, gender, then obviously the income indicators as well. So are there any other, Danny, thinking of cultural factors or cultural sort of mediated social determinants? Are there any other key factors to explain the excess suicide rates in some populations in Brazil, in addition to the First Nations ethnicity?
So just to add something, among the First Nations, the rate is 15. So if you count it, it's higher than other countries. And in Brazil, actually, the rates are increasing. So while in these other countries, the rates are higher compared to here, they are decreasing, but here we are seeing it increasing.
Sorry, Danny, you were just saying there that, that's really stark. I mean, three times higher, the rate in First Nations people. So are there other factors?
So in Brazil, it's very complex, a range of factors that influences. We face, as we mentioned before, racial inequalities, income inequalities, there are also other some regions in Brazil that have higher rates, for example, in the south of the country. And also, we still face lots of stigma around suicide, as in many other parts of the world. And it may stop people from trying to access mental health care. It has been improving, but we are not quite there yet. The other challenge is that we have a strategy, but we still don't have a national plan for suicide prevention. And the community health services here, they are mainly focused on the severe cases of mental disorders. So unless you have a diagnosis, a severe diagnosis, you are likely to have less access to care. So I always ask that we need more specific programs to prevent suicide and to be assisting people in risk of suicide and self-harm. So there are a range of factors. While we are still not quite there in preventing them and building strong programs that could actually combine the socioeconomic assistance with the mental health approach.
Yeah. No, in terms of, because the thinking of the strategy and action plan, it's one thing having a strategy, an aspiration, but it's really, if it's not backed up in action plan, it makes it particularly problematic. And did you say earlier as well that in terms of access to mental health services, was it you said that the First Nations people are less likely to present to clinical services? So they're obviously not culturally sensitive or appropriate for that or accessible.
Yes, definitely. They live in more remote areas. And like for the community mental health services, only about half of the municipalities in Brazil actually have these services. The other half don't, which means the smaller ones actually don't have. Mm-hmm. So they live in more remote areas. The other barrier in access is that these services many times are not prepared to attend them and are not trying to combine and respect the cultural. So they have their own way of treating the mental issues. But when you go to the services, we have this standard way that we learn from the books, and we are not always welcoming all the ways of assisting those people. That's why research like ME research is so important to listen to them and try to identify what the needs are. And then these programs should be tailored in a way that assists their needs. Another problem I forgot to mention is, I would like to add as well, is the problem with access to lethal means. In Brazil, pesticides regulation, we have a pesticide regulation, but you still can access the pesticides, and they are freely sold all over the country, although it's against the law, but they are freely sold. If you go in a certain area, you still can buy it, and you say, I'm going to buy it to kill rats at home, which is a wrong use of pesticides, and you still can buy easily. So this is another problem, and if you see the rate in Brazil, there is a big proportion of people who die by suicide using those pesticides. So it's another problem we have here.
Yeah, it's going to be such an important area because that's where our evidence base is strongest, is we can restrict access to lethal means. It saves lives. Amy, then going back to you, in terms of, you've touched on what we do know in terms of the social determinants, but what about our gaps? What, I mean, again, if we're thinking about where you think we should prioritize in our research, both in a, you're speaking obviously from the UK context, but also in a global context.
Yeah, well, I think one of the issues is, you kind of named it earlier, Rory, would be around kind of intersectionality, actually, and, you know, kind of looking at sort of the complex ways in which, you know, different kind of social determinants of suicide might intersect in different ways, you know, for different groups. I think that kind of, we're really at the sort of starting point of starting to think carefully with those kinds of intersections, because there's ways of approaching that research where you're kind of just adding together risk factors. And I think that can be quite limiting, particularly, again, when you have an interest, as I do, in, like, you know, what those things do to how people make sense of their experiences and why that might then lead them to move towards suicide rather than a different response to, you know, to their distress, to the things that they're facing in their lives. So I think kind of sort of starting to develop better understandings of intersectionality, both in terms of, you know, how that plays out for the big numbers and the statistics in terms of outcomes, but also more particularly for how people experience their lives and why they may choose particular responses, which might look like suicide or self-harm or related practices, and then using that to inform how we think about responding to them. would be one area. And I think another area, which kind of what Diana was just talking through made me think about in terms of kind of access to different types of care that might be more culturally appropriate or relevant to the needs that people might have in terms of their kind of broader lives and the things that they're facing that might be shaping their experiences related to suicide and suicidal distress. So some of the work that we've been doing in our more recent work with different communities across Scotland who are affected by suicide is kind of been underlining the importance of community-based supports that are not mental health focused at all and are actually focused on kind of providing sources of connection, advice on how to access benefits and support with accessing safe housing, navigating some of the kind of complexities that we have in the UK of a benefit system that's often very punitive and experienced as very shameful to access. And so, you know, thinking about the role of broader services and supporting people's lives to make them feel better, as well as, you know, the importance of having effective crisis support as well. But, you know, just making sure that our approach to suicide prevention is really very broad and considers those other things that might lead someone to a certain place. But actually, can we look at, you know, supporting them before they get to that crisis point? You're muted.
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more there, Amy. Is it? I just had a conversation just earlier today with Simon Wesley, who's a psychiatrist in the UK. And Simon also sits on the UK's NHS board. And actually, we had a very similar conversation. We were thinking more broadly about mental health. And what he was saying was, you know, from him looking from the inside, in a way, as on the board, and you can just see, obviously, how overwhelmed services are, and including mental health services. And part of that has been, he described as sort of the one of the sort of outcomes of us promoting mental health more now, is that more and more people are seeking help for services or for mental health concerns, and are seeking mental health services as they see their own concerns. And of course, serious mental illness and whatever way it manifests really needs mental health support. But oftentimes, people now report obviously loneliness or disconnection and social isolation. And of course, that they're really important, but that's mental health services aren't going to solve that. That's when we need to look at these broader programs like community-based stuff that you touched on there, Amy. And because that's a bit, the if we're to prevent suicide, and we know from the evidence base for preventing suicide and treating it as a public health priority is social disconnection ending is a huge issue. So anything we can do promotes connectedness, sense of self-worth, will hopefully support and ameliorate any mental health difficulties, and also maybe make it more likely that the people who really need the support for their mental health concerns directly are more likely to get the help and support that they need. So Danny, the same question for you is, what do you see as the sort of key gaps in terms of, again, if you had several millions of pounds or whatever, dollars, what would you prioritize in terms of what key gaps are there in terms of suicide prevention, thinking about this social determinants element?
So I would, if I had these millions and millions of dollars, I would invest in improving the quantity, the coverage of the services, and they also how they are addressing the suicide cases, the risk, people in risk of suicide and self-harm, trying to be more specific, culturally specific. But I wouldn't only focus on that. I would also focus on approaching the social determinations. Because as you mentioned, since all these services are so overwhelming, a way of decreasing the need is if we intervene at the base of pyramid, mm-hmm. on the social, economic, basic needs. By doing so, we are able to prevent many cases of getting too severe and then need care. So I would invest at least half of the money on approaching the social determinations. And by social determinations, I mean poverty, inequality, lack of access, and they're also promoting approaches that increase people connectedness, people connection and interactions. As you mentioned, Roy, it's very important. We know that connection, social connection, is a very strong factor that prevents suicide. So I would do both to try to expand the number of services and the accessibility, but I would also invest at least half of it on the social determinations, thinking of trying to decrease the risk of severity. So no, I would work on promotion and prevention as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree entirely. And actually in Scotland, I think we're the first country in the world in which we've, in our vision statement for our 10-year National Suicide Prevention Strategy and Action Plan, it is not only is it trying to reduce suicide, but it's trying to reduce the inequalities that lead to suicide. Now, that's a huge endeavor because it indeed is trying to tackle poverty and all the other indicators of and causes of inequality. But it's really important that, and it's really taking that genuine public health approach, which is vital. Maybe then, Amy, back to you on then, that sets us up for thinking about, I don't know, whose responsibility is suicide prevention, right? And so we assume it's in part, we hope, governmental responsibility. So what would you, obviously, Danny's already said tackle poverty and so on. So we've got that. Are there any other things you think we should be really tackling in terms of the social determinants or what governments should be tackling and prioritising?
Yeah, so I guess I'm going to build on that because obviously I do agree that tackling poverty would be an important one. I think something that's looking more explicitly at redistributing wealth, so it's explicitly about reducing inequalities as well as actual, you know, people struggling. But another kind of crucial aspect of that, I think, should be about...
How would we do that?
I mean, I'm fascinated by the cash transfer programs, I must say. I think, you know, so the evidence there, it should be, you know, is so telling. And I wish that other governments were taking those kinds of findings more seriously. But I think looking at unconditional cash transfers and considering more carefully as well the, you know, the debilitating effects of, you know, the kinds of policies, for instance, that we have in the UK, where we have got a benefits system and access to welfare for people who don't have, aren't able to work for various reasons. But there are conditions attached to that. There's a huge amount of shaming that's attached to that. And, you know, people, so how people feel when they are in a position where they're having to, you know, access or rely upon the state for their, you know, basic needs, that it doesn't have to be that way. And I think, you know, if governments could kind of address that and kind of take, you know, more of a human rights approach to people's ability, you know, everybody's right to live, you know, free from shame and with the basic amenities for life would be a starting point, I think, for trying to shift some of, you know, not just the kind of like basic material access to the things that we need to live, but also being able to do so in a way that doesn't make us feel awful when we're doing that. And so I think, you know, your point, Rory, about the kind of the importance of making sure, for instance, that people with severe and enduring mental illnesses can still access mental health care. But, you know, absolutely, they also need to have, you know, the basic conditions for life met as well. And, you know, often, you know, some of the work we've been looking at recently around looking at reviews of completed suicides in Scotland is demonstrating the really complex intersections between experiences of poverty and severe and enduring mental illnesses and how that is producing deaths. So,
yeah, I suppose it's in a way, one solution or one potential model could be a universal basic income. I mean, and that, no, I can't see that ever being introduced in the UK. But again, that's the sort of thing we're talking about, isn't it, Amy?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, again, in terms of taking seriously, you know, some of the strongest indicators we have around what produces suicide, mental distress, and physical health problems, all sorts of other social problems for people's lives, these are key aspects of it. And I think, you know, but it does require political will to do that. And I share your pessimism, Rory.
Well, hopefully, I wish I could be more optimistic. And then I suppose then the little thing just struck me is then thinking about like new ways of working. I think there, I mean, I'm slightly more optimistic that we're now prior. So in the 20, 30 years I've been working in this area, globally, but most of it, certainly mostly in high-income countries, there's definitely been an increased focus on mental health and suicide prevention. That's been great. Now, it's patchy, obviously, across the world, it's patchy, that focus. I suppose then, just to sort of, we're coming to the end of our time together, is I'm just curious, and again, what if you had a superpower, right, and your superpower was to allow you to help the world prevent suicide, and maybe start with you, Diane, what would be the superpower that you think could, or what is there a single thing that we could do or a couple of things that we could do? I know this is a difficult question, which would really make a huge impact in terms of saving lives.
Honestly, I would implement what you just talked about the universal basic income. And I think in some moment, some time in the future, we won't have an option anymore because the automation of has been happening now, and in the future is going to be even more. So there will be a very high decrease of jobs available. So it's going to be a reality that many people, they won't be able to get a job. And I think the universal basic income would prevent not only suicide risk, but also improve mental health. I know that it's hard to understand for people that come from different contexts, but giving money to poor people in Brazil means that less children are on the streets.
Yeah.
It decreases the risk of sexual exploitation. There are many, many researches, and including qualitative researches, that we heard things like awful, like truck drivers saying, oh, I cannot find a girl 12, 13 years old anymore on the street. So it's a serious thing. It's maybe hard to understand if you come to a set of context. But in Brazil, we are addressing the very, very basic and urgent needs of people that has no other option but having this help from the government. And for me, this is a moral and human right. So I'll have to end with that and repeat a bit of what I said, but I really highly believe that this would be the approach I would take.
Yeah, no, I mean, that resonates so much with I was involved in this project called this MQ Mental Health Project, which we were looking at what were the priorities for action to reduce mortality, premature mortality from mental illness and mental distress. And obviously what came through time and time again was structural inequalities, racism, gender-based violence, stigma, all the issues you're talking about. But I think the theme, I suppose, which runs through our conversation today is seeing suicide prevention and a life free of this, seeing suicide as the only option, is a human right issue. So, Amy, can I give you the last word on this then, in terms of a superpower idea? I know we've covered a lot of ground here, but so is there anything else you think, oh, right, there's something else we could really do which could maybe make a huge difference?
Well, aside from what's already been said.
Yeah, aside from all that,
I guess one thing, and I'm really conscious we've not talked as much about it, but in terms of a superpower that would help with this, I think alongside something like a universal basic income, would be to look and fix gender relations and gender inequalities, you know, both in terms of the way, as you flagged just there, Rory, that gender-based violence can impact hugely on women's mental health, but also there are very complex intersections between gender inequalities and the higher rates of suicide we see among men. So, you know, there's obviously a huge way to go in terms of how we make sense of and respond to those inequalities and how they're understood. But I think if they didn't exist, if that was my superpower, then I think that would also help quite a lot. So,
yeah, no, I think that's an important point, and something actually, as you know, I think Amy, Susie Bennett, who works with me, and we've been doing quite a bit of work trying to understand male suicide and that complexity in terms of masculinities and the intersection between the genders is complex and is embedded in generations of history, which certainly haven't been helpful, I don't think, at all. Okay, so any last things? That was a really wide-ranging conversation. And again, what's also came out is that it's learning. It's a bi-directional learning here because there's so much we can learn from your experiences in Brazil, Diane. And I think that's another thing which struck us when we were doing this review of, again, the evidence, and was it still, sadly, most of the evidence is overwhelmingly from high-income countries, despite the fact that, as we know, whatever it means, 3/4 of all suicides, or even more than 3/4 now, 79% of all suicides, I think it is, are from low and middle income countries. So any last words from either of you, Diane?
No, just to thank you for the invitation. It was lovely and lots of learning here. And thank you, Amy, as well, for all the comments. I really learned a lot. Thank you.
And last word from you, a parting word from you, Amy?
Yeah, I mean, just again, similarly, thank you, because I think it's just, it's such a hugely important issue. And it is, you know, one of the positives about the shifts that we've seen in suicide research over the last, you know, few years is that even though some, such as Steve Platt, have been talking about this for a very long time, it does feel like it's been taken perhaps more seriously, at least by the research community. And so let's see how far we can get with the political community next.
Exactly. And on that note then, thank you so much, both. I think it was a really fascinating and wide-ranging discussion. And hopefully our audience enjoyed it too. And you can find it, if you Google Amy and Diana, you can find out lots more about their work, which is available online. So thanks a million on behalf of YASP, and have a great day.